fake court dates issued in immigration cases, the idea to buy out homeowners who live in flood zones near Biscayne Bay, and policing pot on Miami Beach. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Katie Spitalski, in for Tom Hudson this week. People are being scheduled for their immigration court hearings on national holidays, on days that don't actually exist on a calendar, and even in the middle of the night. They're called dummy dates, and they're coming from federal agencies. Also, the Army Corps of Engineers is looking into ways to mitigate flood risk around Biscayne Bay. That includes buying people's houses in vulnerable areas. And Miami Beach City Commissioners have come up with a way to deter people from smoking legal hemp and illegal marijuana in the streets. Plus, your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
First. Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S.-China trade dispute looms over President Trump's meeting with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, whose country counts China as one of its largest trading partners. In a joint news conference at the White House a short time ago, Trump was asked if he'd be willing to cut an interim deal with China.
We're looking for a complete deal. I'm not looking for a partial deal. China has been starting to buy our agricultural product, if you noticed, over the last week, and actually some very big purchases. But that's not what I'm looking for. We're looking for the big deal.
Trump also suggests he feels no pressure to reach a complete deal before next year's presidential election. The president is denying any wrongdoing in his conversations with foreign leaders. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the president's denial follows a whistleblower complaint that reportedly relates to an inappropriate conversation the president had with a foreign leader.
News outlets report that the intelligence community whistleblower flagged concerns about an allegedly inappropriate conversation that the president had with a foreign leader. Speaking to reporters at the White House alongside Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Trump dismissed the whistleblower's complaint as a, quote, ridiculous story.
I've had conversations with many leaders. They're always appropriate. I think Scott can tell you that. Always appropriate. At the highest level, always appropriate.
The president also called the whistleblower a partisan, but he then admitted that he does not know the individual's identity. The whistleblower's complaint, meanwhile, has become the subject of the latest standoff between congressional Democrats and the administration. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Thousands of registered nurses nationwide are on strike. They're pressuring Tenet Health hospitals in California, Arizona, and Florida to pay them more money and provide better working conditions overall. The nurses are expected to return to work tomorrow. Massachusetts regulators are investigating MIT for allegedly dumping nitrogen wastewater at its facility on the state's North Shore. According to tests commissioned by private research university, the water contained more than 20 times the amount of nitrogen permitted by state authorities. We have more details on this report and on documents obtained by ProPublica and Max Larkin with member station WBUR.
The documents show that an agricultural research team repeatedly dumped water with high levels of nitrogen into an underground well in 2018. Excess nitrogen can cause harmful algae blooms, and it can be toxic to infants. But it's not clear whether the contaminated water wound up in water supplies. Former lab research lead Babak Babakinejad says he tried to stop the dumping and alert MIT safety officials.
I wanted to address this as soon as possible. Unfortunately, I was faced with resistance instead of cooperation.
MIT officials say they're temporarily pausing all of the lab's work at the site as they seek a solution with the state.
That's Max Larkin reporting. This is NPR. Young people around the world are taking a stand for the preservation of this planet ahead of the first UN Youth Climate Summit this weekend in New York. They are moved by what many rebuke as a weak response by the globe's leaders to collectively work toward addressing the adverse effects of climate change. Students skip school to march in cities on virtually every continent. The youth-led movement is inspired in part by the Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg, who has implored elected leaders in this and other countries to unite behind the science on climate change and to do something about it. In Afghanistan, officials have updated their death toll from a U.S.-backed airstrike targeting ISIS fighters. They now say that at least 32 people have been killed, many of them civilians. And NPR's Dee Hadid has the latest from Islamabad.
Ataullah Khagiani, the spokesman for the provincial governor, provided the updated casualty toll as more residents reported family members killed or injured in the airstrike that took place overnight Wednesday. It struck farmers who were resting after harvesting pine nuts in eastern Afghanistan. Reuters reported that village elders had even written to provincial authorities to let them know that farmers would be in the area because ISIS is also active there. A spokesman for US forces said they believe they struck militants of the Islamic State, but said they were working with local officials to determine what happened. The UN estimates that nearly 400 civilians were killed in the first 6 months of this year in Afghanistan from similar aerial strikes. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
The Dow is up 51 points since the open. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ADP, an HR partner committed to designing a better way to work with HR, talent, time, benefits, and payroll. Informed by data and designed for people. Learn more at design.adp.com.
Rising sea levels, hotter temperatures, and red tide are just a few threats that face our fragile state. A new original production from WLRN explores the impact of human behavior on our environment as seen through the lens of one of South Florida's most beloved and fragile underwater creatures, the sea turtle. Troubled Waters, A Turtle's Tale, premieres October 3rd on WLRN-TV, your South Florida's storyteller station.
Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Swatowski, filling in for Tom Hudson. Federal agencies have been issuing fake court dates in immigration cases. The United States Citizenship and Immigration Services and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, have been sending people notices to appear at times when court is not actually in session. The agencies are trying to comply with a court ruling about filling in documents that can be used to deport someone. We're joined by Miami Herald immigration reporter Monique O'Madden via Skype. Hi, Monique.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I wanted to ask you, fake court dates sound pretty unbelievable. Why is the government sending them?
Sure. So late last year, the Supreme Court decided that any document, any notice to appear sent out by the U.S. government without a time and place listed on there would be considered inactive. It would not be considered legit, in other words. So what the U.S. government started to do is actually put these dates and times on their documents. However, they're fake. So people are like, why not put real dates? The problem is that they don't have the capacity or the electronic ability, right, or the manpower to actually communicate with the courthouse on the spot to issue a court date that is actually available when the person shows up in court.
Is it a shortage of available court dates? Are there just too many court dates to schedule?
Not at all. It's just it's kind of like when you get a ticket from a police officer. Usually you'll get a to be announced on the ticket. You don't immediately know when you have to show up to court. What you do is that you go home and you wait for a notice that tells you when you have to show up to court. It's the same process. Here, what they're doing, it used to be that that's how it would be, right? You would go home and wait for that exact date. So you would basically wait for the U.S. government to coordinate with the courthouse. What's happening now is that in order to speed up the process, and what immigrant activists are saying, this is intentional so that immigrants get shorter periods of times on record here in the U.S., and it basically blocks them from getting certain protections.
It sounds like that coordination's not going on. How long has this issue been going on of fake dates?
At least a year.
Wow. And what's the legal precedent for allowing these federal agencies to issue fake dates in the first place? Are they getting in trouble at all?
Well, that's still unclear. They're not talking about it. They won't answer our questions. What we do know is that they're not acknowledging that there's an issue. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, in your reporting, you've had a chance to talk with some people who have shown up to a fake court hearing. What have they been able to do about it so far? Is there any recourse for someone who gets a fake date?
Definitely not. These people are still waiting for their real court date. It's interesting because they've been called to show up at midnight, national holidays. They've made, you know, journeys across several counties. Some people go across the state to make it to immigration court. And it's quite a cost for them, not just monetarily, but their time And emotionally, I spoke to one woman who said she was having a panic attack because she thought that if she couldn't believe her court date was fake. So she didn't want to leave the courthouse because she was afraid that she'd get deported.
And how does this fit in with the ongoing debate over immigration as a whole and immigration policy for that matter?
Well, a lot of people say that it's just an absolute mess. I can't speak to that, but, you know, people I've interviewed say that it's just one more dent in the system and that it needs to be fixed. People shouldn't be issued fake dates. They should be issued real dates. And that's something that's just simple to them.
Is there any advice for someone who is waiting for an immigration court hearing and may be worried about getting a fake date? Is there anything that they can, you know, how worried do they have to be about this? Is there anything they can do on the front end of that?
Absolutely. They should definitely call their attorney beforehand. In some instances, attorneys could find out if it's a real date by going to the courthouse or by calling to see if it's on the actual calendar. In other cases, they might just have to make the trek just to be safe. There are people who take pictures in front of the courthouse just to prove that they were there, despite the discrepancy in the time and place. So it's just calling your attorney is your best bet.
And so what's next with this issue? Is there any end in sight to these fake dates happening?
To be honest, no. And my reporting will go in that direction. But as of right now, no.
You've also been covering the Child Migrant Detention Center in Homestead extensively. The center shut down in early August, but it's still costing the U.S. government millions. Where is that money going?
Well, it's going to the contractor that is contracted to run the facility, Caliburn International, and its subcontractor, Comprehensive Health Services. So they are contracted to run the emergency temporary shelter. And the purpose of it being opened, they say, is that they need to prepare for any emergency. So if there is an influx of migrant children at the border, they'd be sent there immediately. And that it needs to be remained open. It needs to stay open because it costs more money and it's a lot of time to close it and then reopen it.
Are there any children there right now?
No.
Is there any, does this have anything to do with this facility's hurricane plan?
Yes. When hurricane season came, the Miami Herald actually published a series of articles that said that they didn't have a hurricane plan. They were reluctant to share details. They didn't have one. They told members of Congress that it wasn't ready yet. After a lot of pressure, they finally released one, and there was a tropical wave in the Atlantic, and they immediately just shut the place down and stopped accepting new children.
Have we heard any word of children being moved back to the center?
Not yet. However, I am hearing that it could open as soon as next month or November.
Thank you, Monique. We've been speaking with the Miami Herald reporter Monique Madden.
Thank you.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Immigration is a big issue for the Latinx community here in South Florida. Two of the biggest expat groups, Colombians and Venezuelans, are also watching what's happening in South America. There are concerns that Colombia and Venezuela could be heading to war. The Venezuelan government has been accused of backing guerrillas to start up the civil war again in Colombia. Meanwhile, the U.S. and more than a dozen Latin American nations decided this week to invoke a hemispheric treaty and promised to defend Colombia if it's attacked by Venezuela. WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, joins me now to explain all this. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Katie.
How likely is it that Colombia and Venezuela are going to war?
Not really likely. The problem that I'm hearing from experts, the big fear, is that when you have a very erratic head of state like Venezuela's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, sort of rattling sabers the way he's doing right now toward Colombia, as one expert told me, and Frank Mora from Florida International University, who heads their Latin America Center there and who was also the Defense Department's point man for Latin America under President Obama, I think he put it best. He told me accidents can happen and those kinds of accidents can escalate. So that's what's got people on edge. Not so much that there's a real likelihood that Venezuela and Colombia could go to war, but you've got this really erratic president in Venezuela who could really screw things up.
Is it enough of a chance that all of these nations have come together for a treaty about it?
Well, this treaty was written back in 1947, and it's rarely, if ever, been brought out, you know, from mothballs since then. We haven't had a war in South America between two countries since the 1930s. But the reason the U.S. really brought this out was that, as you know, we have an opposition leader in Venezuela who declared himself this year the legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. So with Maduro acting so erratically lately and as I said before, rattling sabers at Colombia, he suggested to the United States government, the Trump administration, that they bring this treaty out and get the rest of the hemisphere to say, look, if Venezuela does in any way attack Colombia, that would be an attack on all of us in the hemisphere, which is essentially what the Rio Treaty says. And therefore, that's what they said this week at the Organization of American States, the United States, and about 19 other countries who are part of this treaty. They said, okay, we'll have Colombia's back if this happens. Again, all this is very symbolic, but it raises tensions. And again, when tensions start bubbling up like that in a very volatile situation like Venezuela, bad things can happen.
So this sounds like a very precautionary, just in case we need it kind of treaty.
Exactly. I mean, what we've got here is essentially you have Colombia accusing Venezuela of backing these Marxist guerrillas. As you know, Colombia just ended its half-century-long civil war about 3 years ago. So we're all thinking, great, everything's great in Colombia, we've got peace. Well, now, just late last month, the Marxist guerrillas in Colombia, the FARC, the leaders of that group, said, nope, we're going to take up arms again against the government, we're going to restart this civil war. Colombian government is blaming President Maduro in Venezuela for pushing the guerrillas to do this.
What have the guerrillas been doing since the Colombian Civil War ended 3 years ago? Why do they want to go back to war?
They claim that the Colombian government has not fulfilled the peace agreement program, that too many poor rural Colombians, for example, have not seen the kind of economic assistance that this peace agreement was supposed to give them. Too many sort of social organizers in rural Colombia have been assassinated. But, you know, you've also got other problems, like many of these leaders of the FARC, these Marxist guerrillas, have been indicted on drug trafficking, and they stand the chance of getting extradited to the United States. So they're feeling nervous. There's a whole cauldron of reasons for why these Marxists suddenly want to go back up into the mountains with an AK-47 and start a civil war again. But the big issue here, as I said, is that Colombia is blaming Venezuela. And most experts that I've talked to say they've got reason to blame Venezuela for, as I said, pushing the rebels to restart this civil war. That then has angered President Maduro in Venezuela, and he's been holding military exercises on the border with Colombia that, again, are raising tensions.
So there's tensions on both sides. Mm. Why is it in Venezuela's advantage to push the guerrillas? Why, you know, is it to their advantage to go to war with Colombia?
It's not to its advantage to go to war with Colombia. It is to Venezuela's advantage to see the Colombian guerrillas restart the civil war in Colombia, because that undermines the Colombian government, whom Maduro hates, because he believes, and probably rightly so, that the Colombian government would like to see the socialist regime in Venezuela ousted.
And there have been military strikes?
Not military strikes, but as I said, military exercises, very bellicose military exercises by Venezuela on the border. But again, this a war is unlikely. And the big reason is that, you know, as we often joke here, the Miami-Dade County Police Department could beat Venezuela in a war. That's how bad the Venezuelan military is. It's very threadbare these days. So it would be suicidal for Venezuela to actually attack Colombia and go to war with Colombia. But what we are seeing, though, as I said, are these bellicose military maneuvers by Venezuela. And again, it raises tensions.
What are expat groups in South Florida saying about this on the Colombian side and the Venezuelan side?
Well, you sort of divided. In the expat community here in Venezuela, you do have a large group of people who think the U.S. should stage a military intervention, that it should invade Venezuela to solve this political and terrible economic crisis in Venezuela. Most of the Colombian expats here in South Florida, they tend to be very conservative, and they too believe that Colombia should not be tolerating these shenanigans from this socialist state in Venezuela.
Is there a possibility that all of this coming from Venezuela is a way to try to get military intervention?
Not from Venezuela. Venezuela, you know, I think what they want, this socialist regime in Venezuela, its supporters are dwindling. The supporters it does have, it wants to make them believe that the United States is poised to invade Venezuela. That helps the regime politically. It makes them look like they're defending Venezuela's sovereignty against the great evil, imperialist of the North, meaning the United States. So you've got all of those kinds of hemispheric dynamics. Especially the bad blood between Venezuela and the United States, all operating. And again, war is not likely, but it could become likely if these tensions get out of hand.
And the U.S. is meeting with several Latin American countries on Monday. What are they hoping to achieve?
Well, what they're going to be discussing this coming week is, okay, now that we've invoked this treaty in which we all say we will have Colombia's back if it's attacked by Venezuela, what does that mean? That's what they're going to be trying to hash out. Because, as I said, this treaty was written in 1947 and has barely been even looked at since then. So I think they're going to be sitting down and trying to figure out, what does it mean that we've invoked this treaty? What are the next steps we take? It could mean perhaps tighter economic sanctions hemispherically against Venezuela. We really don't know. We'll know next week.
Sounds like there might need to be some tweaking on that.
Yeah, like I said, they're going to have to go back and reacquaint themselves with this treaty.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's editor, about the tensions between Colombia and Venezuela. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, how flood risk around Biscayne Bay could impact homeowners.
Each week on the South Florida Roundup, we talk about the biggest stories from Key West to Palm Beach, and we hear from you. So tune in Friday at 1 to the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
You can stoke the engines of creativity and engage the gears of independent journalism if you represent an automobile dealership and would like to ignite an in-kind partnership with WLRN for our fall membership campaign. Please contact Bee Berman at friendsofwlrn.org.
Memorial Breast Cancer Center brings the strength of one of Florida's largest breast cancer programs into one location, so patients see their entire cancer-fighting team in one day. Memorial is dedicated to helping breast cancer patients stand strong against cancer through prevention, advanced diagnosis, treatment, and recovery. When strong is your only option, Memorial Breast Cancer Center is here to be strong for you. Learn more at mhs.net/breastcancer.
One of our WLRN listeners once contacted us to ask, why do South Florida highways have so many nicknames? And the WLRN news team responded by doing a radio story on it. Great journalism often begins with a simple question, and we're waiting for yours. Is there something about South Florida you've always been curious about? Just text your question to us at 786-786-7636. Standard messaging rates apply.
Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski. Tim Hudson's out this week. Hurricane Dorian spared South Florida. That's after it stalled over the Bahamas and brought storm surge as high as 20 feet. Now the Federal Army Corps of Engineers is looking at how to protect areas around Biscayne Bay from future hurricanes like Dorian. It's called the Back Bay Study. It proposes putting up floodgates, surge barriers, and even some natural remedies like restored mangroves. One of the more controversial plans involves buying people's homes from them in areas that are vulnerable to flooding. We're talking about resiliency on the South Florida Roundup. Do you live around Biscayne Bay? Did you recently move there? How did you factor in flooding to your decision to live there? Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're calling from in South Florida. Texting from. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. We're here with WLRN's environment and climate change reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Good. When we say floodgates with this Back Bay study, what do we mean by that?
So these are actually gates that they're proposing they would put across the Miami River, the Little River, and the Biscayne Bay Canal. It's not clear yet how big they are, but they would have to be sizable. They've used the gates in New Orleans as an example. Some of those gates rise 32 feet above sea level, so it would be a fairly sizable piece of infrastructure.
And they seem kind of complex. I mean, a big piece of infrastructure. How are they going to affect neighborhoods? What goes into putting them up?
Well, so the gates across the rivers probably wouldn't affect the neighborhoods that much because the gates actually go across the river. The flood walls would be sort of a bigger burden on neighborhoods because what the Corps has told some of the homeowners is that they would need right-of-ways around them to maintain the walls. The size and scope of the walls depends on a lot of things, the kind of soil, the amount of water they have to hold back. This early plan that the Corps talked about last week didn't have a lot of details because they're in the early phases.
Well, and with these flood walls, I mean, what's the state of flood risk in those neighborhoods that the Corps would need right of way around?
Well, so what they did was identify seven areas around the bay that they looked at historic records for flood damage, and they also looked at property values and kind of what's built there. So based on the flooding record, they identified these areas, and it's not just the flood. They looked at elevations and all kinds of things, but they're targeting these seven areas: Aventura, North Beach, South Beach, Cutler Bay, Arch Creek. I am leaving one out.
That's okay. I've got the list right here, actually. It's Aventura, Cutler Bay, Little River, the Miami River, North Beach, South Beach, Arch Creek.
Right.
And when we talk about how vulnerable these areas are there some that are more at risk than others?
I think so. I mean, it depends on elevation and where you are around the bay. The bay kind of is like a big bathtub. So when we get storm surge, that's why it's so bad. The water comes in and then it pushes up against land and it kind of sloshes around in there. So they're looking at these areas that historically have flooded a lot around the Little River. That, you know, obviously the areas closer to the river, those are flood prone. So I didn't get a lot of details on exactly what kind of flooding they experienced. I just know that the Corps has said, okay, these are the ones that we want to look at.
And you can join the conversation on the South Florida Roundup. Maybe you live in one of those seven areas we just mentioned. Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Or you can send us a text to 786-786-7636. Jenny, when it comes to what the Corps is coming out with this big plan, why now?
So this, after the 2017 hurricane season, very brutal, we had Harvey, Irma, Maria, the Corps had already been looking at coastal risk, the risk to coast from storm surge, but they decided to speed things up a bit. The Corps kind of is known for moving slowly. A few years ago, with Everglades restoration, they decided, we're going to start doing these studies much faster. We're going to take 3 years and $3 million. So in October 2018, they signed an agreement to do the Back Bay study. And this was one of, I don't know how many, but countless studies up and down the coast. This is being handled by the Norfolk District, and they are doing coastal risk management studies from New England all the way down here. And so, based on the hurricane season, too, some areas took priority based on their threat from storm surge, because what they're looking at is not the chronic flooding that we get from sunny day, you know, from king tides and high tides, but storm surge from hurricanes and big storms. That's
so worst case scenarios.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get to this idea about the seven areas that we just mentioned that the Army Corps of Engineers is looking at, and they've mentioned you know, elevating buildings in some of these areas versus other areas potentially buying people out of their homes. And so what of these areas are considered economically valuable enough to elevate the buildings versus the areas that may not be and they're looking at buyouts? What's the difference between those two areas?
So what they say they're doing now, they've done a little bit of, but they're going to go deeper into it, is a real cost-benefit analysis. And those are just sort of hard numbers where they look at, here's the property that's at risk, here's the value, and here's the cost of the flood control measure that we're considering. Does the cost outweigh the benefit? And it's a, when I talked to the study, the project manager, she said, you know, we'll work closely with the community, but there are some people in the community, UM's Environmental Justice Clinic, that are already sort of sitting up and paying attention and worried that some low-income neighborhoods are not going to get the benefit of the kind of flood protection that might be given to areas where the property value is higher.
It sounds ripe for potential environmental injustice if property values are a part of this cost-benefit analysis, are they?
They are. And that's the question at hand, is how, what's going to be the calculus? How do you factor in things that are harder to quantify in terms of dollars? The Corps has already been criticized by as not doing a good job of sort of measuring the dollar value of natural barriers like mangroves and wetlands and things like that. So I think the question is, what about those social benefits too? You know, there's value in living close to your school or being close to work. And if the Corps decides that property is not worth protecting, or that the flood control measure is too expensive to build, then what happens to those properties? And, you know, you want to factor in other issues, which is what the environmental justice people are saying. That's what we want to pay attention to.
Well, I know you've been working on a longer, really in-depth feature story about homeowners who could be potentially affected by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers buying their home from them. Can you tell me what the most interesting thing, or maybe a couple of interesting things that you've found in your reporting that really just brought this story home for you?
Well, the homeowner in particular that I talked to had moved from Miami Beach because of flooding issues. This was, they were buying their first home. And so they actually paid a lot of attention to flood maps. They researched it. They talked to their realtor. They talked to the neighbors in the neighborhood they ultimately settled in. And so they were very surprised to find that their house was near an area that might get bought out.
And that feature story will be airing on WLRN next week. I'm speaking with WLRN's environment and climate change reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, about how to save flood-prone areas that surround Biscayne Bay and what some of the more extreme options that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is looking into that might mitigate that flood risk from climate change. You can join the conversation. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Or send us a text to 786-786-7636. We got a text from Jonathan in Miami. He says, I live in Shenandoah near Coconut Grove. This being an older neighborhood is at one of the highest elevations in Miami, towering at 11 feet above sea level. We chose this area in part because if the National Flood Insurance Program disappears, much of Miami housing instantly becomes unaffordable. Jenny, what do you think about that?
Well, the insurance question is a big one. And if you don't have public, you know, the National Flood Insurance Program, then will private insurers step in? I mean, we've seen what happened with windstorm insurance. So I think it's a big, I think he's right to be concerned.
Well, have you, you know, in your reporting, did you run into any homeowners that love the idea of, hey, someone will come buy me out if I'm too vulnerable of an area?
No.
It's a big concern. On the flip side, for these other areas that the Corps is looking into to elevate buildings, that's a huge undertaking. Do we know yet what the Corps is estimating in terms of like how long that will take or how much that would potentially cost?
No, and that was one of the questions a lot of people had, was how much will this cost? I mean, it sounds like it will be in the billions. It could be, I mean, they've done other plans in New York City. They've talked about a lot of these same things, and it is very, very costly. But this, I want to make clear, they're in the early stages. It's kind of a tight timeline. They're going to have a tentative plan in January 2020 and a draft plan in the spring of 2020, and they're taking public comment now. So they want to hear from people now at the meeting they held last week with homeowners. You know, they were very frank about some of the dramatic changes that they're proposing, but they also made clear that, you know, we want to hear from you. This is, you know, you got to help us out with this plan.
If someone wants to give input, how can they do that?
There is a web address. I can give it now, or you can go to WLRN.org and you can find our stories, and the contact information is in there.
And I'm curious, I know you just got back from the youth climate strike on Miami Beach. What were you hearing from young high schoolers about sea level rise and flood risk?
They are very passionate, very enthusiastic, lots of chanting. They are mad. They feel like their future is at, you know, imperiled because we're not doing enough to address sea level rise, and they want, as they say, action now. I mean, they're impatient.
Well, the idea that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is just in the beginning stages of this Back Bay study, it kind of is at odds with the idea that these high school climate protesters are saying we're not seeing things happen fast enough.
Right. And I think their focus is a lot on mitigating climate change. So they want things done to cut carbon emissions. They're looking at sort of the causes, or at least that's what I was hearing, more than how are we going to like build infrastructure to keep our roads dry.
Well, and what about natural remedies like restoring mangroves? I know you said the Corps has been a little criticized for not looking at that kind of option enough. Is that something that could potentially we could see more of?
That's what environmentalists down here are pushing for. And the Corps, it's in the mix. It's in the mix. The criticism from the congressional, I'm forgetting the name of the organization, was that they didn't do a good job of calculating the value. And therefore, when you did the cost-benefit of analysis, the natural barriers didn't get a high enough ranking. The environmentalists, like Miami Waterkeeper, are saying that needs to be elevated. We need to do a lot more. You know, our natural coastline, our mangroves, our wetlands, our seagrass meadows, for thousands of years have been fending off storm surge. So and a lot of that got wiped out with development. So why not do more to restore those areas?
Thank you, Jenny.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. And coming up next, you can hear more about how the Back Bay study is impacting homeowners next week here on WLRN. Still to come, the mayor of Miami Beach is policing hemp and pot here on the South Florida Roundup.
The Florida International Trade and Cultural Expo is back October 9th and 10th at the Broward County Convention Center. You can attend the FITSE World Expo Marketplace and meet buyers and sellers from over 60 countries. Free registration at FITCExpo.com.
You are invited to the premiere screening of Troubled Waters, A Turtle's Tale. WLRN Public Television's new one-hour documentary reveals the impact of human behavior on our environment, as seen through the lens of Florida's sea turtles. Join us at the Philip and Patricia Frost Museum of Science in Miami on Tuesday, September 24th at 7 p.m. for the film screening. A discussion with film participants will follow. Learn more at WLRN.org. This film is made possible through major funding by the Joe Asmundson Production Fund and additional funding by the Batchelor Foundation, Royal Caribbean Cruises Limited, GeoSyntech, and Florida Power and Light Company.
Everglades restoration, sea level rise, algae blooms. It can all be a lot to keep track of, so we want to help you stay connected on everything about the environment. Please join WLRN's Environment Text Letter to have the latest news delivered to your phone. Subscribing is easy. Just text the words Enviro News, two words, to 305-363-6687. Standard text messaging rates apply.
Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. We're back with WLRN's environment and climate change reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. We've been talking about flood risk in Biscayne Bay, and we've had a couple people write in to us. Mary from Pompano asks, has the state of Florida ruled out the possibility of building dikes around South Florida, as we've done to protect the Netherlands back in the 1950s?
Well, one of the things that the director of this coastal program for the Corps said is, we're not the Netherlands. The Netherlands is the size of a state. You know, the U.S. East Coast is huge, so that's not an option. They can't afford to build dikes and flood walls everywhere. But like they're recommending or going to recommend in the study, they are putting up flood walls in places and floodgates in places. You can't wall off the whole thing, but you can kind of put Band-Aids across vulnerable areas.
And are there any local plans happening? I know we've been talking a lot about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and this Back Bay study looking at Biscayne Bay, but trickling down from the Army Corps, what's happening at a more local level?
Right. So counties and cities are coming up with their own plans. The city of Miami passed a bond. I can't remember if I think it was $400+ million. Miami Beach has plans. Those are being created. And one of the concerns that was raised with the Corps is that they want those local plans woven into the Corps' plans. They don't want the different governments doing things that ultimately could contradict each other. So like if the city of Miami is proposing to restore stretch of mangroves along the bay, and then the Corps wants to build a flood wall, you know, they need to be talking to each other and they need to be linked together. The homeowner had told me, you know, she's very concerned as somebody who lives on the bay, like, why can't some of these barriers and structures work like public spaces too? So like parks, make it amenable to the people who live there, walking pedestrian spaces. You know, don't just think about the protective measures. Let's have some design too.
Mixing art and environmental right. design. I like it. We got a text from someone, area code 786, that asks if property is prone to flooding no matter how beautiful and valued the owners think their home is. And does that make the property pretty much worthless? In 2007, with the housing bubble, 300,000 homes were devalued to less than 100,000. Housing values are at risk. So this person says oceanfront properties should not benefit from our taxes to build a protection wall. Have you heard other responses like that?
Well, I think that's going to be part of the calculus. I mean, we do beach restoration, right, to save the coastline. Some people would argue, like, why are we doing beach restoration when it erodes naturally? You know, that's just to protect property value. Part of this analysis they're going to do is look at if you have a neighborhood with $1 million homes, you build a flood wall that costs less than that. That would probably be a kind of protective measure that you could justify because you have property value that generates and helps the tax base. It'll pay for itself because these people are paying taxes. I mean, there's a whole, I don't mean to say though, I know there's a whole school of thought that that's just a waste of money because ultimately the water is going to, you know, get too high and ultimately it will be underwater. So what's the point of just building a flood wall now? And I'll leave that to the to the water managers to debate.
And is anybody left debating that right now?
No, I think there is that debate going on. There's among the scientists, the climate activists, government managers. And I mean, that's all part of the the Corps itself. The director of this program, Joe Vitri, who is in our story, said there are places where we know we can't protect them, that we're going to have to leave.
Well, thank you again, Jenny. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We're going to move over to policing pot on Miami Beach. Now that smoking hemp is legal statewide, it's causing problems for local governments that want to prohibit smoking marijuana, which is still illegal. The substances are similar enough in chemistry and smell that recently Miami-Dade County's state attorney's office has said it won't prosecute minor pot possession cases. And in Broward, the state attorney has a new 3-gram minimum before they'll prosecute. Miami Beach is working on its own solution to be able to stop smoking in the streets and on the beach. City commissioners said yes on the first vote to an ordinance that would arrest people for smoking hemp or pot in some public spaces. Violators could face up to a $500 fine and possibly jail time. It still needs to pass a second vote, which is set for next month, before it can move forward. I spoke with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber about the ordinance he proposed. Mayor, recently the Miami-Dade County and Broward County state attorneys have changed how they're prosecuting marijuana cases. What options do local governments have to enforce illegal pot use?
Well, the problem is that when the state legislature legalized hemp, they inadvertently created a problem in that because hemp, when it's smoked, and marijuana when it's smoked, smells the same, and because the THC levels are close, you can't arrest somebody now, according to both those state attorneys and other state attorneys, because they don't know whether they're smoking hemp or they're smoking marijuana. So the state attorney in Dade County actually announced that they would not be prosecuting minor pot offenses. So as of right now, if you're smoking and you're, you know, in a public right-of-way, which is where you can't even drink liquor, our police will not arrest you, which is a problem because they know that they won't be prosecuted. So our city commission is about to address that.
You had a letter to the editor in the Miami Herald this week where you compared the situation to consuming alcohol in public spaces. Can you explain that a little bit, how this is akin to an open container law?
Yeah, I mean, our open container laws say you can't drink liquor, you know, on sidewalks and in certain places that are just open. We have open container laws in the state, and we have them in our city by ordinance. So what I propose to do is simply take the pot and hemp laws prohibition and just put it and treat it exactly like open container laws. I don't think we're looking to do more enforcement than has previously been done. We're simply trying not to lose our ability to enforce it where it should obviously be enforced. For instance, next to a school, in a public park, on the sidewalk. People shouldn't be smoking pot next to an elementary school, obviously, but the fact that the state attorney and the police can't prosecute and arrest you for that right now because of the testing makes it a problem. So we're simply going to say, let's just treat pot and hemp just like liquor. It's not an increase in enforcement. It's simply a substitution of a new type of enforcement for a new ordinance locally that had previously been enforced by the county prosecutor with police officers.
So this new ordinance, will it consider hemp the same way it considers marijuana right now because you can't tell the difference?
Correct. That's exactly what we'll do. You can't smoke hemp or pot next to a school or in a park or in an open. Anywhere where you can't drink, you can't smoke hemp or pot.
And so this all kind of happened and came together because the state started allowing cultivating hemp.
Yeah.
How is the city of Miami Beach dealing with a potential for a more widespread market for hemp?
Well, I mean, listen, we don't regulate everything. That's just not, that doesn't happen on a municipal level. All that regulation comes from the state of Florida or the federal government. And so we'll deal with whatever they allow. In this case, because of the way the state statute was written, I think the legislature created an unintended impact of not being able to prosecute pot laws anymore on a local level, because it wasn't just our state attorney or Broward. A bunch of state attorneys across the state of Florida said, hey, now that you've said hemp is fine to smoke, how are we going to arrest anybody for pot? There are a bunch of states that have legalized pot. None of them allow pot to be smoked in the places where it currently could be smoked in Florida because of this glitch. So we're not doing anything Puritan, in a sense, or trying to increase enforcement. We're just trying to make sure we can enforce it sensically because of this glitch.
Have you had any response from the legislature on this effect?
Well, they're not in session yet. They're starting their committee weeks only now. So I don't know what they'll be able to do, though, unless they reverse the hemp issue, because hemp, you know, chemically is proximates itself to pot. It's just the THC level is lower. Its smell and texture is very similar. So, you know, I guess it's, you could argue that this was not unintended, it was foreseeable. But I certainly don't think that the state legislature, in a state where there still is, where non-medicinal pot is still illegal, would have purposefully wanted to make pot possession and use next to a school or in a park legal. Obviously, they didn't intend to do that. So maybe they'll do something, but we have municipal prosecutors. We have our own police department, and we're going to treat it exactly the way we treat pot now. We're going to just tell people, please put out the cigarette, and they should listen. If they don't listen, then they're making a choice to be arrested. But I'm not going to let people smoke pot in our parks and next to our elementary and junior high and high school. I'm not going to let that happen, obviously, without enforcing it, because that would be absurd.
violators could face up to 60 days in jail and or, you know, a $500 fine. Have you had any criticism that that sounds a little harsh?
Well, look, I'm sure there are people who say, hey, pot should be legal. Again, in all the places it's legal, you still can't smoke it next to an elementary school, in a park or in a public space. I mean, look, I'm a parent and I've had kids in all three levels of school. Nobody wants pot smoking next to a school or in a park. They just don't want that. In an entertainment destination like ours, it could really proliferate. So we need that ability to enforce it. And by the way, anybody who's going to be arrested is making the choice to be arrested, because our police tell you, just pour out the beer or put out the joint. And if you don't, well, then you're sort of an idiot and you're deciding you want to be arrested. But you don't have to be arrested unless you disobey a police officer's lawful command. We just want to make sure they have a lawful command to make.
Since the state has allowed for cultivating hemp, do you know if Miami Beach police have run into any scenarios yet where this gray area between what is legal hemp and what is illegal marijuana has been an issue?
Well, it's only been a few weeks. And since we haven't been making arrests, we wouldn't know whether we could have arrested somebody smoking hemp or they were smoking pot. In other words, because of the issue precisely raised by the prosecutors, that issue being you don't know, I think there haven't been a lot of arrests, if any, since this change in the law. And certainly since the state attorney announced recently that they're no longer bringing these cases, there haven't been anything going on, because we're not arresting people we can't prosecute.
And what sense are you getting from your fellow city commissioners about how they're feeling about this ordinance? And have you heard any response from Miami Beach residents?
Well, the PTAs, the Parent Teacher Associations, have reached out and supported it. It passed the commission 6-0, I think, in its first vote. I don't talk to the commissioners outside of meetings. We're not allowed to because of the Sunshine Law. I hope they support it. It's a pretty obvious thing. Our police chief supports it, and that's the reason I brought the legislation forward, because he said our cops are limited in what they can do. We need to have a tool. This is a really needed thing. I think it's pretty obvious it should be an ordinance and that it should be enforced thoughtfully.
Well, thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
We reached out to Miami Beach Police after our interview with Mayor Dan Gelber. We wanted to ask if there have been any arrests for smoking in the streets in Miami Beach. The police department responded by saying there have been no arrests or seizures of hemp in Miami Beach. And students from Tallahassee all the way down to Miami Beach have been skipping school today to join a nationwide youth climate strike. It's still going on Miami Beach, and our environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich was telling us a huge turnout. More than 300 students, police are estimating, came to skip school to advocate for climate change. So Gabriella Marchesani helped organize Miami Strike, and she's a senior at Miami Country Day School.
For people that are just saying we're a bunch of kids, we're a bunch of youth that believe in science and we want action.
The strikes were inspired by Swedish teen Greta Thunberg after she staged a protest at the Swedish parliament in August 2018. Up to 600 strikes across Florida, the U.S. are planned. 20 are being held in Florida. And Gabriella says she's disappointed South Florida schools won't excuse students from class. More than a million students are being excused in New York City.
Missing one day, not even a full day of school, to do something that could possibly change the way our lawmakers, politicians, how our government works. They should encourage that. They should encourage students to take action.
The Miami-Dade County School District says it's holding climate change activities on campus today. And in Broward County, there's been a lot of controversy over students who aren't getting excused absences, who have been punished for handing out climate change flyers. And you can find all of that on WLRN.org. While the absences won't be excused in South Florida, parents can sign students out to attend the strikes. And that will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. All the show's technical supervisor today is Richard Ives. I'm Katie Switalski, filling in for Tom Hudson. Thank you for calling, texting us, and listening in. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Broadway in Fort Lauderdale and Les Miserables, the Tony Award-winning musical with new staging and reimagined scenery inspired by the paintings of Victor Hugo, featuring songs such as I Dreamed a Dream, On My Own, and Bring Him Home. At the Broward Center, October 8th through the 20th, tickets at browardcenter.org.
Join us for the premiere screening of WLRN Public Television's new film, Troubled Waters, A Turtle's Tale, held at the Philip and Patricia Frost Museum of Science, Tuesday, September 24th at 7 p.m. Learn more at WLRN.org.
The Fish and Wildlife Foundation of Florida is celebrating its 25th birthday. With a mission to conserve the state's lands and waters, the foundation works with partner organizations to preserve the Florida panther, manatee, and other iconic species. The foundation helps to manage thousands of acres of wildlife, from public game lands to coral reefs and freshwater springs. It is also Florida's largest private funder of outdoor youth programs, benefiting more than 200,000 kids annually. More at wildlifeflorida.org.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I bring you the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, old-time music, and folk music. Plus interviews this week in the studio with Sister Mary Beth and J.D. Danner and Jesse Campo and Tim LaRoque and The Summit. The Public Storyteller with Dr. Karen Neal is at 4 o'clock. Folk and Acoustic Music Sunday starting at 2.
As a favorite author, actor, musician, or comedian, at All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the news of the day. We introduce you to the coolest people you thought you knew and learn what really makes them tick. What you hear might just surprise you. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, conversations that connect.
There's music in the air at WLRN every day. Tracy Fields hosts Evening Jazz Monday through Friday starting at 9:30. Michael Stock and Folk and Acoustic Music starts at 2 on Sundays. And The Night Train with host Ted Grossman comes your way Sundays at 8 p.m. Tune in and enjoy.
Tune in and enjoy indeed here on 91.3 WLRN and HD1 Miami, Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1 Marathon, Key West, 90.7 WFLV HD4 West Palm Beach, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches. It's 2 o'clock.